second generator. Sam and Remy went with the doctors to get the first generator up and running at the hospital and then returned to the beach to get the second generator when Miguel returned and bring it to a medical clinic that was still standing across town. The work went on all day and much of the night. As they distributed their cargo to various parts of town, they heard many stories. People were working with shovels and tractors and trucks to clear the roads to cities along the coast. Others with homes that had remained intact were taking in those whose homes were destroyed. Through the next 5 days, there were aftershocks from the enormous quake. The first few were sharp and lasted uncomfortably long, but they seemed to get milder and less frequent as the days passed. On the evening of the sixth day, Captain Juan was waiting on the rear deck of the yacht when Sam, Remy, and the others returned in the lifeboat. His face was grave. Remy nudged Sam. "I think we're about to get some bad news." Remy, Sam, the three doctors, George, and Miguel gathered while Juan fidgeted and cleared his throat.
"This afternoon I got a radio message from the charter company. They've been patient about things, but they want us to bring their yacht back to Acapulco."
"Why?" asked Remy. "We're still willing to rent it, and we haven't hurt the boat, have we?"
"It's nothing like that," Juan said. "They've been nervous because we've been using a luxury yacht to haul supplies, but they knew it was necessary and that we can fix anything that looks worn. But they've got a schedule to keep. In 4 days, another group will arrive in Acapulco, expecting the yacht to be waiting for them. There are contracts."
He shrugged and held out his empty hands to pantomime his helplessness. "How much time do we have?" asked Sam.
"They want us to leave tonight. That will give them a day to have the decks cleaned and polished, the engine serviced, and new supplies loaded. I'm sorry."
"All right," said Sam. "We've unloaded all the supplies we brought here days ago, and now there's no need for the yacht. What do you think, Remy? Want to go back to Acapulco with the boat and fly home?"
"Not yet," she said. "I think we should stay a few more days. I've been hearing that the people who live near the volcano still need medical care and supplies."
"Are you sure?" said Juan. "That's not an easy trip."
"Don't get me wrong. I've seen you both working when I was ready to drop. I'm proud to know you."
"We all are," said George.
"It's been a pleasure for us, too," said Sam. "But we'd like to try to help the people on the mountain. Right now, we'll go below and pack our things so you can get started for home."
Dr. Martinez said,
"I think I'd better go back with the boat, if I may. I've been away from the hospital as long as I can be."
Sam turned to the others. "Dr. Garza?"
Dr. Garza said,
"Dr. Talamantes and I are staying for a few more days, too. And by the way, please call me Maria. We've been through so much together. I feel as though I've known you for years."
"And call me Christina," said Dr. Talamantes.
In a short time, the group was reassembled on the aft deck with their backpacks. George and Miguel helped them into the lifeboat and took them back to the beach. When the boat was empty again, Sam and Remy pushed it off into deeper water.
"We'll miss you," said Miguel.
"Good," said Remy.
"Friends should miss one another.
But we'll all have stories of adventures we can tell when we meet again."
As the lifeboat putted out to the yacht, Sam picked up their backpacks, and he and Remy walked off the beach and up the street toward the schoolhouse that was being used for temporary shelter. He said,
"You know we're stranded now, don't you?"
"Stranded in a tropical beach town with the man I love?" Remy said.
"Big deal."
"A very romantic thing to say for a woman who's been shoveling gravel and asphalt into cracks in a runway. I just hope those adventures you were talking about are as much fun as you implied to Miguel."
She went up on tiptoes and kissed him.
"This will be fine, and we'll do some small bit of good. If we weren't here, we'd be at home, bugging the electricians and carpenters, so our house would never get finished."
"You're right," he said.
"Let's go see if there's room for us to sleep in the school. We'll call Selma so she doesn't get worried, and tomorrow we can ask around to see how to form a relief party to the mountain."
Chapter 4. Volcán Tacaná, Mexico. By noon the next day, Sam and Remy were among a dozen volunteers sitting under the hot sun in the back of a flatbed truck, bouncing along the bad road toward Volcán Tacaná. Beside them were their former shipmates, Dr. Cristina Talamantes and Dr. Maria Garza, and on the other side were others they had come to know during the past week. There were two brothers in their 20s named Raúl and Paul Mendoza, who had been brought up out in the countryside near the volcano, and a tall, quiet man named José, who'd had a law office in Tapachula that had been damaged by the earthquake. José Sanchez had a thick mustache that veiled his mouth, so one seldom knew whether he was smiling or frowning. As they rode away from the city past miles of cultivated fields on their way into the interior, Remy stared into the distance at the blue triangle of Tacaná. Cristina Talamantes noticed.
"There doesn't seem to be any more smoke. Maybe it'll settle down again for another 100 years or so."
"And maybe it's saving its strength to spit fire and ash on our heads and bury us in lava," José said. "The word Tacaná is Mayan for house of fire."
"Let's hope it doesn't live up to its name for now," Sam said. They rode for another hour before they reached the small town of Unión Juárez. There were two small brick buildings along the main street that had partially collapsed and two others that had lost some roof tiles. In the central square, the driver and the Spanish-speaking volunteers got out to talk with the people loitering there. Sam and Remy stuck close to Cristina, who obliged them by translating. After talking briefly with an Indian-looking couple, Cristina told the Fargos,
"The road ends in about 7 kilometers.
"Then what?" asked Sam.
"Then we walk," she said. "The lady says it's a foot trail, and there are lots of smaller trails branching off of it that lead to the mountain villages."
Remy said,
"Did she say anything about conditions up there?"
"She warned me that it will be cold. It's over 13,000 feet at the top."
"We're ready for that," Remy said. "In fact, I have some things I can share with you. I brought some shells and fleece linings on the yacht because sometimes the Pacific can be cold at night, especially when the wind blows."
"Thank you," said Cristina. "I brought some warm clothes, too, and so did Maria, because we thought we'd be sleeping outdoors. But we may take you up on your offer in a day or two."
"Did the lady say anything else?"
"They've had some avalanches from the shaking, and some of the village's water supplies may be contaminated. There are a few injuries that Maria and I can treat, and possibly some that we can't. Those people will have to be evacuated."
Sam said, "We'll look for places near each of the villages where a helicopter can land."
"Thank you," said Cristina. "Right now I'm going to the church to join Maria and see if we can interview people who have come down from the mountain to find shelter. Want to come?"
When they entered the church, Maria and Cristina met with 5 families from mountain villages. As they talked with the parents, the children came to Remy and sat on her lap. They were fascinated by her long auburn hair and loved to hear her sing little songs in her exotic native language, English. She gave them protein bars with nuts and chocolate as treats. After a while, the truck driver appeared in front of the church, and everyone climbed into the flatbed truck for the last leg of their ride. Where the road ended, there was a stone to mark the beginning of the foot trail. Each of the volunteers climbed down from the truck and shouldered a heavy pack full of supplies. They all helped one another adjust load straps and then set off. The walk up the steep mountain trail was hard and slow. The forests had been cut and cleared for most of their journey, but had never been cleared on the mountain, so foliage overhung their path. They made camp on a level clearing surrounded by trees with fruit that looked like small avocados the Mendozas called criollo, and slept until dawn when the sun woke them. As they reached higher altitudes, the lowland trees were replaced by pines called pinabete. They followed the same pattern for 3 days, breaking camp each morning, walking until they reached the next village and meeting with its inhabitants to find out what kind of help they needed. At each one, Cristina and Maria examined patients and treated injuries and illnesses. Remy assisted them, keeping the inventory of medicines and supplies, bathing and bandaging and administering prescribed doses while the doctors moved on to the next patient. Sam worked with a crew of volunteers and local farmers to rebuild and strengthen houses, replace broken pipes and wiring, and fix generators to restore electrical power. At the end of the fifth day on the mountain, as they lay in a tent at the edge of a village near the 2,500-meter level, Sam said, "I have to admit, I'm glad we decided to do this." "Me too," Remy said. "It's one of the most satisfying times of my life."
"You have wonderful taste."
"You have wonderful self-esteem," she said. "And I'm going to sleep." The following morning, Sam and Remy led the way to the last village. They took the smaller side trail that the mayor had told them led to their final stop, and soon they were getting too far ahead of the others. They waited until the others could see them and then went on. But before long, they were much farther ahead again. Sam and Remy reached a slope that had suffered an avalanche during the night and covered a stretch of the trail with dirt and rocks that looked like basalt. They made a detour above it, carefully navigating around the big boulders that had fallen. Then they both stopped. One of the enormous chunks of basalt that lay in the path was not natural. It was a perfect rectangle with rounded corners at the top. Without speaking, they both stepped closer. They could see the carved profile of a man with the hooked nose and elongated skull of a Mayan aristocrat and an elaborate feathered headdress. There were columns of complex symbols that they could tell were Mayan writing. They both looked up the side of the mountain, their eyes following the gash in the green foliage upward, tracing the path of the avalanche to its beginning. Irresistible attraction made them begin to climb at once. They went up the steep hillside to a surface that was perfectly flat like a shelf, about 30 feet long and 20 feet wide. The space was bordered by trees, but there were none within the ring. They could see that a portion of the shelf had broken off and gone down in the avalanche. Sam dug down a few inches with his knife, and they both heard the blade strike stone and scrape when he moved it. Remy looked around her. "A patio?" she said. "Or an entryway?" They looked at the sheer face of the mountain. There was one area that had a layer of new dirt on it which had fallen from higher up on the mountain, and a bit of a recessed spot. "This looks like it might have slid down when the big block fell," Sam said. He poked it with his knife, then set down his pack and took out his folding shovel. He used it overhand, scraping down more of the dirt from the rocky wall.
"Careful," Remy said. "We don't want to bring down the rest of the mountain."
But she took off her backpack, took out a hatchet they'd used for splitting firewood, and joined him. When the dirt was cleared, they faced a wall of black volcanic rock. Sam stabbed at it with his shovel a few times. It was brittle and porous like pumice and chipped off in chunks. He nodded at Remy's hatchet. "May I?"
"Be my guest."
She handed him the hatchet. Sam hacked at the layer of volcanic stone, knocking it away.
"It looks as though at some point there was a lava flow and it must have come down like a curtain."
"Over the entrance?"
"I didn't dare to put it that way," he said. "We don't know it's an entrance to anything, but that's sure what it looks like."
He hacked harder until a bigger chunk fell inward and a hole appeared.
"You just had to knock hard," said Remy.
"What do you think? Tomb?
Way up here? I'm guessing a sacred place, like a shrine to whatever god was in charge of volcanoes."
Sam enlarged the opening, took his flashlight from his pack, shone its beam into the hole, and then stepped through the opening.
"Come in," he said. "It's an ancient building."
Inside was a room made of cut stone, then plastered in white. All of the walls had been painted with colorful pictures of Mayan men, women, and gods in a procession of some sort. A few humans sacrificed to the gods by cutting themselves or pushing thorns through their tongues. But the figure that dominated the pictures on each wall was a skeleton with dangling eyeballs. But Sam and Remy didn't let their flashlights linger on any of these scenes. They both stepped deeper into the room, drawn by a singular sight. On the whitewashed stone floor lay the desiccated body of a man, dark and leathery. He wore a breechcloth and a pair of sandals of woven plant fiber. In the stretched lobes of his ears were large green jade plugs. There were jade beads around his neck and a carved jade disc. They both ran the beams of their flashlights up and down the withered figure. Beside the man's body was a wide-mouthed, lidded pot. Remy twisted the neck of her flashlight to make the beam wider.
I've got to take some pictures before we get any closer.
Or before there's another aftershock and the roof falls in. Remy handed Sam her flashlight, then took flash pictures with her phone. She circled the dead man, taking every angle. She shot the four walls, the ceiling, the floor, and then the pot by the man.
He's mummified. He looks a bit like the Inca mountain burials, and the Moche and Chimú on the Chilean coast.
He does, said Sam. But this isn't a burial.
No, Remy agreed. It looks as though he was sheltering here, at least temporarily, and died.
He's got carved out wooden vessels over here with some seeds in them. Probably the fruit just rotted away. There's another one that could have been a rain catcher. He's got an obsidian knife in his belt, and a few flaked pieces he used for carving over by the wooden trough. Remy was photographing the pot, which was painted with Mayan scenes that seemed to be about one man, eating, wielding a shield and a war club, kneeling to a fearsome-looking deity that seemed part feline and part troll. Sam said, I wonder what was inside.
Whatever it is, it's probably still there.
The lid seems to be stuck on it with some kind of seal, like glue. We'd better not try to open it or we'll damage it.
Get out of the frame. I want to send these pictures to Selma before my battery dies.
Good idea. Sam stepped out through the hole in the lava curtain, used his phone to take pictures of the entryway and the mountainside above and below him. As he shot downward toward the trail and the chunk of worked stone that blocked it, he saw the rest of the volunteers coming along. Hey! He shouted. Up here! The column of people stopped and looked up, and he waved his arm so they would spot him 200 feet above them. They hesitated for a moment and then began to climb toward him. While Sam was waiting for the others to arrive, Remy came out of the shrine's entrance onto the surface where he stood.
What are you doing?
He pointed down at the others. I asked them to come up to take a look.
I suppose we couldn't keep this to ourselves.
Not even for a day. Not with that carved doorpost lying on the trail down there. We're going to need their help to keep this place safe until we can turn it over to the authorities.
You're right, she said. This could be an important find. I'm not aware of any other mummified Mayans.
In a few minutes, Cristina and Maria, the Mendoza brothers, and Jose Sanchez joined them. Cristina looked around her.
What is this place?
We're not sure, said Remy. It's a Mayan ruin, and it seems to have been buried in a lava flow. We think it's a shrine or a holy place, probably dedicated to the mountain. The Mayans also had lots of gods that lived in the sky or the interior of the earth. On a volcano, I suppose it could be either. I remember one called Bacab who did both.
Maria looked at the entrance.
Can we go inside without damaging it?
We've been inside, Sam said. It should be okay as long as you don't touch anything. There are the remains of a man in there. He's been mummified. Not intentionally, but by the conditions. The altitude and the dry air up here probably preserved him the way it preserved the mummies in Peru and Chile. At some point, a lava flow sealed the entrance, and that probably made a big difference. The volunteers all took their flashlights and went in one at a time. As each one came out, another entered. When they had all been inside, they stood on the flat entry, hushed and looking awed.
What do we do about him?
Asked Paul Mendoza.
Jose Sanchez said, We get the news out. Then people will pay to come up here.
No, said Maria. We've got to get the authorities up here. The archaeologists can't do much right now, said Cristina. The roads are closed, and when they're reopened, it would be wrong to evacuate a corpse first when there are people down there waiting to be transported to hospitals.
He's not just a corpse, said Sanchez. He's a national treasure.
Whether he died yesterday or in 900 A.D., the point is that he's dead, said Maria.
He's not in danger, like a patient who needs a transplant. If we make sure he's preserved, that's all we can do for him.
Sam held up a hand. Please, everyone. It never came up before, but Remy and I have some experience with this kind of find. We've been on archaeological expeditions in different parts of the world. We don't know when this man came to the shrine yet, but he has an obsidian knife and nothing that's made of iron or steel. The site looks like the classic Mayan period, which means it's probably from between 300 and 900 AD. You saw he has jade jewelry, which places him in the highest social class. He was probably either a priest or a nobleman. Scientists can learn from him. We're not aware of any classic Mayan remains that are so well preserved.
What do you think we should do? Asked Paul Mendoza.
Normally we'd say to seal the entrance up again and call in archaeologists, said Remy. But we're in the middle of a disaster area. It will be a while before they're able to get here. And there's no way to hide the site with that carved pillar on the trail.
Sam said, I think we've got to try to stand watch over the site for the night. Then we can get the mayor of the last village to understand the importance of this site to the people so he can persuade his neighbors to help. Other parts of Mexico and Central America have benefited economically from archaeological sites. People will want to come and study this one and possibly do some excavating. But if we tell outsiders about it now, advertise it widely before the scientists can study it, then it will be destroyed. Looters and pot hunters will come and dig everything up in all directions before scholars can get here.
You're pretty sure of everything, aren't you?
Said Sanchez. He was angry.
Of that much, anyway, said Sam. We've seen it happen. Priceless artifacts were taken before they could be identified, walls undermined and broken, human remains thrown aside and exposed to the elements.
And what if it did happen? We own it, not you. Anything from the old days belongs to the people of Mexico. It's ours by law and by moral right. These people were our ancestors.
You're absolutely correct, Sam said. Every Mexican citizen owns 113 millionth of what we found. We'd like to see those citizens all get their share, and that means turning him over to the Mexican authorities.
Cristina said, Jose, don't be a donkey. This is a piece of Mexican history.
Of course we'll preserve it.
You're awfully friendly with Sam Fargo, aren't you? That ride on the yacht must have been very pleasant.
Sam said the doctors came with us because the roads were out and they needed to get here to help the injured. Please don't insult them by implying it was anything else. Maria said something very rapidly in Spanish through clenched teeth. Jose Sanchez looked shocked and a bit ashamed.
I'm very sorry I said that. Please accept my apologies, all of you. I'll go along with everyone else and do my part to preserve what's here.
Thank you, Jose, said Remy.
What we need to do now is set up a camp for the night. It should be a bit away from this site so nobody sees it and gets curious.
I'll look for a spot, said Jose.
He walked off alone, exploring the plateau. After a minute, he disappeared around the curve of the mountain. The Mendoza brothers looked after him, seemingly tempted to follow and have a say in choosing the site.
I'd leave him alone for a while, said Sam. He'll be back when he's gotten over it.
All right, said Raoul.
Sam turned to the doctors. Cristina and Maria, I think Remy and I may have caused a problem by opening the lava seal on the entrance to the shrine. The man who's lying on the floor in there was probably preserved by his airless environment, and now we've changed it. He's exposed to the atmosphere. Do you have any advice?
The best thing would be to freeze him, which we can't do, said Cristina.
Maria said, I think you were right about the conditions up here on the mountain preserving him. The dry, cool days and cold nights above 10,000 feet are ideal. So for the moment, he'll probably be fine. It's taking him down to sea level to a tropical forest that is the risk.
Sam said, maybe we can improvise a container that's cold and airtight and carry him down.
That's our best hope, said Maria.
Where's the nearest ice? Asked Christina.
Above us, said Sam. There seem to be ice fields up above 12,000 feet. I could see them yesterday. Maybe I can climb up and reach the lowest one.
The body bags, said Christina.
Body bags?
Maria said, when medical teams go into disaster areas, sometimes there are fatalities that need to be bagged to prevent the spread of disease. So we carry a few bags. We can use three or four at once to keep the body's temperature even. They're airtight and strong. If we put him inside one and then pack ice around him and put a bag or two over that, he should stay fresh.
I'm going with you, Remy said, just beside Sam's ear. He shook his head. Risking both of us doesn't seem like the best idea.
Climbing up to an ice field alone is a worse idea.
Not necessarily, he said. It should save a valuable specimen.
You're a pretty valuable specimen yourself, and two of us can bring twice as much ice, she said.
Argue with that. Do you get the impression I argue with you just to get my own way?
Never,
she lied. All right, then, he said. We'll both go. She said, at least we'll have those nice body bags if anything goes wrong. Remy and Sam emptied their packs of almost everything but a body bag each, a hatchet for her, a shovel for him, water, and their fleeces and jackets. Then they set off to climb. It was still midday when they began, but the climb was steep. They were able to accomplish the necessary progress without climbing gear because the irregular surface of the mountain offered footholds. After a time, they were on a wind-swept slope above the tree line on bare ground, and felt tired and winded.
I'm glad we spent a few days above 10,000 feet before we tried this, Remy said.
Me too. I just hope this works. I'd like to get up there and be well on our way back before dark.
If we keep up this pace, we should be able to do it.
Sure, he said. Anybody could do it if they could keep up this pace. They laughed and found themselves going even faster. Soon they were climbing in silence, too winded to feel comfortable talking. Once in a while, Sam would turn and say, "You all right?" And Remy would reply, "So far." In late afternoon, they reached the snow-covered part of the mountain and stopped to look ahead. There was a big caldera at the top and three smaller ones along a ridge. Sam pointed to the white streaks. "See? The snow is only on the crests of ridges radiating out from the caldera."
The caldera must be hot, Remy said.
Well, let's see if we can grab some ice and get down quickly. They walked along the rocky badlands between the calderas to reach the streaks of ice. When they got there, they dug down below the snow and found solid ice. They chipped at it with Sam's shovel and Remy's hatchet to free chunks they could break out. They gathered ice until they had as much as they could carry. They put it in the body bags, then wrapped the bags in their fleeces and jackets, put them in their backpacks, and began to walk back toward the top of the trail. As they were hurrying toward the trail, there was a deep rumbling sound, and the rocky ground below them began to shake. They knew they wouldn't be able to retain their balance. They each bent their knees, sat, and slipped the backpack straps from their shoulders while they waited out the earthquake. The shaking and rumbling continued for a minute, then another minute.
"Are you scared?"
Remy asked.
"Of course I'm scared," said Sam.
"I have no idea whether this is just an aftershock or we're about to have the mountaintop blow off and hurl us into the stratosphere."
"Just testing your sanity," she said.
As the rumbling abated, they became aware of a new sound, a hiss that was almost a whistle. It grew to a rushing sound and then a roar that reminded them of an airplane's engine. As they looked around for the source, a cloud of steam rose into their line of sight across the snowfield. It was white, spewing out of the mountain at high pressure from somewhere below them. As soon as they had shouldered their packs again and shifted them to balance the weight of the ice they were carrying, they set off. They walked quickly, sometimes approaching a trot in places where the volcanic rock was clear and solid.
When they reached the beginning of the trail they had taken upward, the sun was low, its rays already horizontal and glaring in their eyes from Mexico on the west side and casting an enormous shadow on the green forests of Guatemala on the east. They moved downward without delay, passing spots they remembered. This time they had to guard against letting their momentum propel them past a foothold into open air. Now they could see the source of the noise and the steam cloud. It was a rift in the rocky mountainside where a plume of hot air and water was shooting out under immense pressure. They edged away from the steam, but they couldn't stray too far without losing their way. Once they were below it, they felt a tentative relief. But an hour later, as they were descending a rock formation that looked like a series of frozen waterfalls, the rumbling in the earth began again. "Better hold on," said Sam, and they both found handholds and sat, Remy's head on Sam's shoulder. They kept their places while the rumbling increased and the mountain shook. The shaking seemed more violent, and it dislodged two showers of rocks a few dozen feet to their left that rolled down, hit other rocks and caromed off into the air, then hit far below with audible impact. The silence returned, and they began to descend again. They had to go more slowly now because in places new rock slides had fallen across their path, covering their old footholds and making them tread on untested spots. When darkness came, they used flashlights to choose every step. The shaking returned once more, but they were in an open, unprotected area where they were extremely vulnerable to falling rocks, so they could only push on. It was not until about 1 a.m. that Sam and Remy reached their starting point. They walked back above the main trail until they reached the site of the ruined shrine. As they approached the little plateau, they could see the artificial glow of a cell phone. "Somebody else must have a satellite phone," Remy said.
"I think Jose does," Sam said.
She called out, "Hello down there! It's us!" The glow of the phone disappeared and a human voice moved along the patio.
"This way!"
It was Jose's voice. He turned on a flashlight and lit the way for them to reach the shrine.
"You must be tired," he said. "I'll show you the way to the camp."
"First, we've got to get our friend on ice," Sam said. Sam, Remy, and Jose went into the shrine. They laid out a fresh body bag and carefully lifted the man into it, then zipped it shut.
"He seems so light," Jose said.
"He's mostly skeleton now," Remy said. "The bones are only about 15% of our living weight, which is mostly water." They packed ice around the bag, slipped another bag over it, and then a third. They heard footsteps approaching outside. Raul Mendoza called,
"It's my turn to stand guard,"
then stuck his head into the entrance.
"Oh, Fargos, it's good to see you. When the mountain was shaking, we all got worried."
"We're fine," said Remy. "After some sleep, we'll be even better." The Fargos followed Jose on what must have been the remnant of an ancient trail on the mountainside to another flat space where all the tents had been pitched. Sam played his flashlight's beam up the mountain. "What's above us?"
"No overhangs or big rocks. Nothing came down today during the shaking."
"Thanks, Jose. And thanks for your help with the mummy."
"Good night," he said.
And the Fargos crawled into their tent and closed the flap to ward off the morning sun that would come up too soon. Chapter 5. Volcán Tacaná. Sam woke to the buzz of Remy's satellite phone and realized that the sun was up already. He patted the floor of the little tent and found the phone.
"Hello."
"Sam?" said Selma Wondrash. "Where are you two?"
"About 10,000 feet up an active volcano called Tacaná. We're coming down today. Is something wrong?"
"I'll let you be the judge," she said.
"I just sent you an article that appeared this morning in a Mexico City paper."
"Okay. I'll call you back when we've seen it." He terminated the call, went online, and found the email with the attachment. He clicked on the article and was greeted by a color photograph of the interior of the Mayan shrine, the body, and the painted pot. "Uh-oh," he said. Remy opened her eyes and sat up.
"What?"
He turned the little screen toward her and she gasped.
"How did that happen?"
Sam thumbed through the article, looking at the photographs. There was a picture of the whole group in the last mountain village. He showed Remy. Remember when this picture was taken?
Sure.
We all lined up, and then... She paused.
Jose handed his cell phone to the mayor's brother.
And then he handed the phone back to Jose. So we know where this came from.
Jose sent it to a reporter, obviously, along with this article.
I'm going to get a better translation than I can do. She took the phone from Sam, ducked out of the tent, and disappeared. When Sam caught up with her, she was sitting beside Christina, who was translating.
The discovery was made by Sam and Remy Fargo, members of a volunteer relief expedition bringing aid to the remote villages on Takana.
She paused.
He gives you full credit, but he doesn't leave anyone out.
The picture has everyone's full name, and the narrative seems accurate.
I respect him for his honesty, Remy said. It's just that we thought we had more time before the rest of the world knew.
Well, we don't, said Sam. We'd better decide what to do. He looked around at the camp. Where's Jose?
Remy stood and looked around. He was guarding the shrine when we came in last night.
Sam began to run. He dashed along the plateau, ascended the narrow path until he reached the place where it widened again near the entrance to the shrine. There was Raul Mendoza.
Good morning, Sam, he said. Buenos dias.
Buenos dias, Sam said. He leaned into the entrance and saw that everything was as it had been. The body was still in its body bags. The pot had not been moved, and the wooden vessels were untouched. He returned to Raul. Did you happen to see Jose go by this morning?
No, said Mendoza. Not since he was with you last night.
I think we can leave the shrine for a few minutes, said Sam. We all need to have a talk.
All right.
They went to the camp where the others were just stowing their tents and gear in their backpacks and putting out cook fires. When Sam and Raul arrived, Remy said,
Apparently Jose took off by himself. His tent and gear are gone.
We should talk.
We've been talking, Remy said.
Everybody agrees that we can't do much to hide the shrine. We can bury the carved stone pillar, but we can't move it. All we can do is make sure we've got the best possible photos of the interior of the shrine and take our friend and his belongings with us. We should also explain to the villagers what they've got here. During the morning, they brought the village mayor and his two closest friends to the shrine, then showed them the article in the Mexico City newspaper. Sam warned them that people would be coming. The ones from the government and from universities should be welcomed, and the others kept away for the present. When they were finished explaining and the mayor said he understood, the volunteers left the shrine. Sam carried the Mayan pot across his chest in a rudimentary sling, and the Mendoza brothers carried the body on a makeshift stretcher, just two poles with the body lashed between them. The doctors sealed the wooden vessels and the remains of the fruits and vegetables found in them in sterile, airtight plastic bags. Every few hours, Sam stopped and drained off some water from the melting ice and made sure the body bags were intact. It took 2 days of walking to get down the long trail to the village of Union Juarez, but Maria used Remy's satellite telephone to call ahead to be sure that a truck was waiting to take them to Tapachula. On the bumpy ride back to Tapachula, Sam protected the pot from shock by keeping it on his lap. The Mendoza brothers protected the mummy by holding the stretcher suspended between their knees where it couldn't touch the bed of the truck. As they drove to the city, Sam spoke with the others. I think that at least until the publicity dies down, we've got to keep our friends' locations secret. Maria, Christina, I'm wondering if I can ask you for a favor. After some discussion, Sam had the truck take them to the hospital at Tapachula. Dr. Talamantes and Dr. Garza went inside alone. A while later, they returned with a gurney and wheeled the body in where they could keep it refrigerated in the morgue. When they came back, they had news. While they had been up on the volcano, the city had made great progress. The electrical power had been restored, the roads to the west and the east were open again, and the airport had resumed commercial flights. The four shared a cab that wound through recently cleared and half-repaired streets to the airport. While Sam paid the driver, Cristina Talamante said,
"Sam, Remy, we'll miss you both."
She hugged them, and then Maria Garza did the same.
"But it will be good to fly to Acapulco so we can get back to our own work."
"We'll miss you too," said Remy. "In a couple of weeks, some people from our foundation will be in touch." Cristina looked puzzled.
"Why?"
"This won't be the last disaster," said Sam. "But maybe our foundation can help in advance to prepare for the next one. We want you and Maria to tell us what needs to be done and to decide how to spend the money." Maria, who was usually the shy one, threw her arms around Sam and kissed his cheek. When she released him, she hurried off toward the terminal. Cristina smiled and said,
"As you can tell, we'll be delighted."
She turned and trotted after Maria to catch up. Sam and Remy sat down in the airport bar. Sam said to Remy, "You know what I'd like? To drink something that's ice cold. It's been a while." He ordered two bottles of beer and called Selma.
"Hello, you two," she said.
"Hi, Selma," said Sam. "We're back in Tapachula at the airport, and it's time for us to go somewhere else. Can you find us a resort on the Pacific coast that hasn't been affected by the earthquake?"
"I'll do my best. Keep your phone where you can reach it."
Before they had finished their beer, Sam's satellite phone rang. "Selma?"
"The very same. You have tickets waiting for an Aeromexico flight to Huatulco in 45 minutes. It's close, but not damaged at all. Your hotel is Las Brisas, which is a very good one on the beach, and your room has a balcony overlooking the ocean. I've rented a car for you, and you pick it up at the airport."
"Thanks, Selma." In Huatulco, Sam and Remy signed for the car and drove to the Las Brisas Hotel. They went to the pool to soak and lie on long deck chairs drinking margaritas. After about an hour, Remy turned to Sam, lifted her sunglasses, and said,
"If you were to invite me to a great dinner at 7 o'clock tonight, I would try to find time in my busy schedule to accept."
They bought new clothes in the shops at the hotel and went to the restaurant at 7. Sam ordered pheasant in almond red sauce, and Remy had seafood pozole with snapper, cod, and shrimp. They selected an Argentine Malbec and a Chilean Sauvignon Blanc to go with them. They had Mexican tres leches cake and polvorones de calle, a local type of cinnamon cookie for dessert. After dinner, they walked on the beach and then went to the bar on the patio to sip a Cabo Uno Lowland Extra Añejo tequila that had mellow undertones of vanilla. Remy said,
"Thanks, Sam. I like it when I can tell you remember I'm a girl and not your old army buddy."
"Not a likely mistake, unless I get hit on the head." He sipped the aromatic, powerful tequila. "This is a nice change for both of us. Living in a tent and spending your days burying sewer pipes is only fun for so long." They finished their tequila, and Remy stood, stepped behind Sam's chair, put her hands on his shoulders, and leaned down to kiss his head, letting her auburn hair fall to both sides of him like a silky curtain for a second, then straightened.
"Shall we?" she said.
They walked, holding hands, to the entrance and went up in the elevator. Sam opened the door of their room, but suddenly put his arm out to keep Remy from entering. He turned on the light and stepped in. The room had been ransacked. His pack and Remy's had been poured out on top of the bed. The closet doors were open, and the extra pillows and blankets had been swept off the shelf to the floor. Sam said, "Luckily, we didn't use the room safe. What's missing from the packs?" Remy pushed some of her clothing aside, opened a zippered compartment in the pack, then stepped back and looked around the room.
"Not a thing. I don't bring fancy jewelry on boat trips, and our only expensive gear is the satellite phones and dive watches. We had them with us."
"I'm not missing anything either."
"Please tell me you still have the receipt from the parking attendant," she said. "The pot is in the trunk of the car."
"Here's the receipt." He held it up so she could see it.
"Let's check anyway."
They took the elevator to the parking garage, found their rental car, and opened the trunk. There was the pot and Remy's computer, wrapped in their jackets, and the airtight packages of seeds and husks with the wooden vessels the Mayan had used. "Everything is here," Remy said. Whoever it was apparently didn't see the car or didn't connect it with us or couldn't get to it.
"What do you think is going on?"
"I don't think it was a regular hotel room robbery. I think somebody recognized us from the newspaper article or the viral internet version and figured we had something valuable from the shrine."
"The pot?"
she asked. "It might be valuable, and it's the only thing in our possession, but they couldn't know that, whoever they are."
"Then the thing to do is get out of here," she said. "We need to make sure these people don't follow us."
Sam said, "We'll check out right now and move to another hotel."
"Where?"
"On the other side of the country."
"Sounds far enough."
"Wait here. I'll go up and use the express checkout and bring the packs down here by the back stairs.
While you're doing that, I'll call Selma and let her know where we're going."
She paused.
"Where are we going?"
"Cancun." He hurried into the hotel. In a half hour, they were on the road in the rental car, beginning the 900-mile drive from Huatulco to Cancun. It was now late in the evening, so there was little traffic. Sam drove hard, watching to be sure they weren't followed. Remy took her turn driving after 2 hours, and they kept going until 4. They pulled over at a closed gas station in Tuzla Gutierrez and slept until it opened at 8, filled the tank, and drove on to Centro on the Gulf Coast. All day they kept changing drivers at intervals until they reached Cancun. They checked into the Crown Paradise Club, showered, and slept until morning. In the morning they drove to El Centro, the central part of the city, to shop. They found a number of small stores that had been designed, built, and stocked with American tourists in mind. They bought a number of souvenirs, all of them cheap replicas of Mayan artifacts, pots, bowls, wall hangings, mats, and fabrics that more or less reproduced Mayan art and writing. Everything bore images of Mayan kings, priests, and gods, but crudely and garishly painted. At a hobby shop, they bought a water-soluble acrylic paint set that included silver and gold paint and brushes. At the hotel, Sam went to work on the genuine Mayan pot from the shrine. He painted designs and altered pictures to make the painting on the pot look as cheap and crude as the souvenirs he and Remy had bought. He used sparkly gold paint to cover the pieces of jewelry the Mayan king wore. Parts of his shield and war club Sam highlighted with silver. When the paint was dry, Sam and Remy asked the concierge at the hotel where they could find a mailing company that would ship their souvenirs home. He replied that the hotel would do this for them. Sam and Remy watched him pad a large packing box, load the pot into it, fill all the spaces around it with the mats, wall hangings, and fabrics, then fill the box the rest of the way with styrofoam peanuts and seal it up. With the concierge's help, Sam and Remy filled out the customs declaration, saying the contents were souvenirs from Mexico, and declared the price they'd paid to be under $100. They paid the cost of shipping the souvenirs to their house in La Jolla, gave the concierge a large tip, and went off to the beach to do some snorkeling in the shallows after their hot morning in the city. That night, Sam and Remy called Selma from their room.
"Hi, you two," Selma said. "What is it this time, a flood?"
"Not yet," said Sam. "We just wanted you to know that we've sent some souvenirs from Yucatan to the house in La Jolla."
"I'll watch for them. Is this one big box?"
"Yes," said Remy. "There's some pottery which we really don't want broken."
There was a very slight pause, during which they could tell that Selma had understood what the package was.
"Don't give it another thought. Or are you on your way home?"
"As soon as we can get a flight," Sam said.
"Have you given any thought to where you plan to sleep when you get to San Diego? The fourth floor of the house is still a process, not a product."
"Until yesterday, we've been sleeping on the side of an active volcano," Remy said. "We'll manage."
"You could stay at the Valencia Hotel. I can reserve a suite or even a villa. Then each day you can walk home across the lawn or down to the beach."
"Sounds good," said Remy. "If we rent a villa, will they let Zoltan stay with us?"
"I'll see if they can arrange it.
I can even bring him there to show them what an exemplary animal he is, Selma said.
Maybe that's not such a good idea, Sam said. 120-pound dog who sits when you say sit is still a little scary.
I'll sing his praises, then, and offer to put up a damage deposit.
Make sure it's enough to cover any kindergartners he might eat.
Sam, said Remy.
We'll call before we get on the plane. Sam used Remy's computer to buy plane tickets home. Then he researched the names of American archaeology professors specializing in the Mayans. It was a pleasant surprise that one of the most distinguished seemed to be Professor David Kane at the University of California at San Diego. Sam emailed Dr. Kane and said that he and Remy had made an unusual find at Volcan Tacaná and attached the Mexican news article about it. He asked Kane if he would meet with them when they returned home. He asked Remy to read the email before he sent it. She did and said, "My advice is, click send."
"You don't think we ought to include something about ourselves? Maybe list the places we've excavated in other countries and so on?"
"Nobody needs to do that anymore. When he reads this, he'll be sitting in front of a computer. He can Google us and get much more than he wants to know."
"I suppose." Within an hour, Professor Kane answered. He said he would be happy to meet with them and was eager to learn more about their latest find. Remy pointed at the screen.
"See that? Our latest find. He Googled us first thing."
That afternoon, Sam and Remy checked out of the hotel and hired a taxi for the ride to the airport south of the city. The driver put their two backpacks into the trunk. As she was about to get into the cab, Remy hesitated for a second.
"What?" Sam said. "Something wrong?"
She shook her head.
"Just a guy waiting outside the main entrance. When we came out, he ran."
"Where to?"
"I don't know. Down the street, I guess."
"Could he be a parking attendant going to retrieve somebody else's car?"
"Sure. That's probably it," she said. "I guess I'm a little jumpy today. Some of the experiences we've had lately."
They got into the back seat, and the driver said in English,
"Which airline?"
"Aeromexico." The cab drove off down the long driveway toward the federal highway. The airport was about 10 miles away, and the traffic was moving steadily, so they made good time. They looked out at the Gulf of Mexico and enjoyed the ride. Just as they could see the airport ahead to their right, a black car came speeding up behind them. It pulled up beside them, and a stern-faced man in a dark suit gestured to them to pull over. The driver muttered, "Policía," and coasted, looking for the best place to stop. Sam looked out the rear window and saw that as the cab pulled over, the black car pulled up behind them and came to a stop a few feet from their bumper. Two men got out. One walked up beside the window of the cab and held out his hand. The driver handed him his license. The man handed it back and glanced at the Fargos, sitting in the rear seat. The second man stood behind their cab and to the right, with his hand on the gun in the holster at his belt. Remy whispered,
"The guy back there is the one I saw running before."
The man beside the driver said, "Abra el maletero." The driver pressed the button to pop the trunk. The man in back of the car unzipped their backpacks.
"What are you looking for?" asked Sam.
The man beside the driver glanced at him but said nothing. Sam opened the door an inch to step out, but the man threw his hip against it and slammed it shut, drew his gun, and held it on Sam. Sam sat back in his seat and kept both hands in his lap. The man backed away from the window. The cab driver said quietly,
"Please, senor, those men are not policemen. They'll shoot all of us."
They waited until the men put the two backpacks in the trunk of the black car, then got in and drove away. Sam said, "Who were they?"
"I don't know," said the driver. "Most of the time, we don't have to deal with people like that. Everybody knows they're here. Narcotraficantes use this as a shipment point. Zetas come to town looking for somebody. Somehow those two picked you. Maybe you can tell me why."
Sam and Remy looked at each other grimly. "Just take us to the airport," Sam said. "We have a plane to catch." When they arrived at the circular drive in front of the terminal, Sam handed the man a large tip. "Here, you earned this.
As they entered, Remy said, "They had to be after the you-know-what."
"I know," said Sam. "If I ever run into Jose Sanchez again, I'll be sure to thank him for all the free publicity he gave us. Let's get to our gate before somebody else tries to murder us because of that stupid article." The flight home took 8 hours, including a stop at Dallas-Fort Worth. As they flew in above San Diego after dark, they looked down at the lights of the city. Remy held Sam's arm.
"I missed this place," she said. "I miss my dog. I want to see what they've done to our house."
"It's good to have a chance to rest up between vacations," Sam said. She pulled back and looked at him.
"You're already thinking about leaving again, aren't you?"
"I'm delighted to be home," said Sam. "I don't have any specific plans to go anywhere."
She leaned against him again. "I guess that'll have to do for now. No specific plans means we won't be leaving tomorrow."
"True," he said. "As of today, we don't even own any luggage."
Chapter 6. La Jolla. On their first day back from Mexico, Sam and Remy walked from the Valencia Hotel with Zoltan, their German shepherd, through the ground floor of their house at Goldfish Point, marveling at the newly remodeled building. Nothing revealed to the uninformed eye that a few months ago the house had been attacked by an assault force of more than 30 men armed with automatic weapons. The thousands of bullet holes that had pierced the walls and splintered the hardwood, the dozens of broken windows, the front doors that had been battered open with a pickup truck, were all long gone. Everything was new. Only the upgrades might have hinted to an astute observer that a battle had taken place here. The steel shutters that they'd had in the original design in case of a once-in-a-century Pacific storm were replaced by a set of thick steel plates that were designed to come down by force of gravity and lock at the press of a button. The surveillance system now included cameras mounted on all sides of the house and even in the tall pine trees at the edge of the grounds. As they walked the floor, Selma sounded like a tour guide.
"Please notice that every window is now double-paned safety glass. I'm assured that a man couldn't break them with a sledgehammer."
Selma walked straight to a bookcase, tugged out a particular book, and the case opened like a door. Sam and Remy followed her into a passage and swung the door shut.
"See," she said, "the light goes on when you open the bookcase. The rest is just the way you designed it."
She led them to a stairway that led to a steel door with a combination lock. Selma punched the code in and the door unlocked. She opened it and took them into a concrete chamber.
"We're now under the front lawn," she pointed at the ceiling. "You'll notice that the ventilation comes on automatically, and the lights. They laid 200 feet of concrete culvert, 7 feet in diameter, to make the shooting gallery."
"We prefer the term firing range," said Remy.
"That's right," said Sam. "If we call it the shooting gallery, we'll have to give people the chance to win Cupid dolls and teddy bears."
"Suit yourselves," said Selma.
"If you'll look behind you, you'll see that I had them install 2 extra-large gun safes so you can store guns and ammunition here.
And over here, behind the bench rest, is a workbench for cleaning and adjusting weapons." Remy said, "You seem to have taken a lot of interest in this project. You never used to care for guns."
"Our experience with Mr. Bacco, Mr. Polyakov, and Mr. Leclerc and their friends has caused me to acquire an affection for firearms that I didn't feel before."
"Well, thank you so much for watching over all this construction," Remy said. "What's at the other end?"
Remy pointed at the far end of the range.
"That's a sheet of steel set at a 45-degree angle to deflect rounds downward into the sand so there will never be a ricochet."
Sam said, "Did they put in the other exit?"
"Yes. Behind the sheet of steel is a second stairway that leads up into the stand of pines near the street."
"Great," said Sam. "Let's go back upstairs and see how the wiring changes for the new electronics worked out."
"I think you'll be pleased," Selma said. "They've been working on it for months and finally finished last week. Instead of one emergency generator, there are now four for different circuits supporting various functions. This is now a very difficult house to deprive of electricity for even a second.
They came up to the short corridor through the bookcase door and back into the office. Selma said,
"That's funny. That wasn't here before."
Sam and Remy looked where she was pointing.